Okay, here we go. Let me start by apologizing for not being with you live. You're watching this you're watching the archived recorded version of this lecture. Unfortunately, I had a last minute travel conflict come up this week. A trip that I was supposed to take last week ended up getting canceled because of the snowstorm. I was flying through Chicago and the O'Hare Airport basically shut down for the day. So the trip was rescheduled for this week, and it meant that I could not be with you during our regularly scheduled lecture time on Wednesday night. I'm actually recording this on Tuesday, and I hope that you're watching it at your convenience. We decided it would be better to do it this way rather than try at the last minute to find another time that everybody could get together online. So we won't have the advantage of doing the live chat as we're having our discussion tonight. However, you can still post to the forums as always, and I will do my regularly scheduled office hours at 10:30 Eastern on Friday, just as we always do. So our topic for today is the economics of the internet, our topic for this week, now that we're in week four, the next to the last week of the class. I hope that you're enjoying everything that we've been doing so far. And as we get towards the end of the term, I'll ask you, as I did last week, to start thinking about what you liked and what you would like to do differently and what you would like to see going forward. We have lots of opportunities to do more of these courses. And I would be delighted to do another one sometime in the near future if you guys can express to me and to others at the Mises Institute what sort of topics and issues you would most like to know about. So let's talk a little bit about the economics of the internet. We've already talked about the internet here and there in our discussions up to this point, but I want to spend a little bit of time focusing specifically on the internet because in part, it's such a great example of lots and lots of the phenomena that we've been discussing up to this point. For example, looking at the second slide here, what are some of these key constructs, issues, subjects, topics that have held our attention over the last few weeks? Well, one is the notion of information as an economic good, right? That people don't buy and sell information per se, or information in the abstract. Markets don't price and evaluate information in a kind of a vague and general sense, but rather people buy and sell specific, discrete, marginal units of goods and services, like directories, or an hour worth of consulting time, or access to the network, or whatever it might be, right? So, you know, the internet per se is not an economic good, but rather the specific services or attributes or aspects of the internet that are tradable are economic goods, right? So physical infrastructure is tradable. Computers, routers, switches, parts of fiber optic cable, and so on. Services are tradable. So much, an hour worth of network time or the legal right to send a certain amount of information across a wire. Those are things that can be traded, right? So remember, all of our basic sort of economic understanding of markets, of exchange, of pricing, of consumer value, and so on, will still apply when we're talking about the internet and things related to the internet. Metcalfe's law is the notion that the value of a network is roughly proportional to the square of the number of nodes, not simply the number of nodes itself, which gives us is a way of capturing the idea that you have this kind of exponential growth. You know, as the network grows, it becomes more and more and more valuable for those who are on the network. It's sort of increasing, the value is increasing at an increasing rate. We talked last week about network effects and network externalities. Right? Remember the distinction being a network effect exists when the value of being on the network is a function of the number of other people on the network, right? Which seems pretty basic to the notion of networks that we're most familiar with, telephone networks and fax networks and computer networks, right? But we talked last week about other economic goods, money, language, the English common law, and so on, being examples of goods with network effects in the same way, right? What's called a network externality, if you like, is sort of a subset of the more general category of network effects. What mainstream economists call a network externality is a case of network effects where those who are choosing to join the network or to choose one standard or another to participate in the networked activity are doing so without taking into account the effects of their decision on other people who are in the network, right? We talked last time about the example of the typing pools, right? That's a case where, you know, each additional typist choosing one keyboard layout or another is affecting the value of that layout for all of the typists. However, the decision maker in that case is not the individual typist, but rather the manager of the typing pool who fully realizes all of the benefits and costs of individual typists' speed and accuracy and efficiency and training time and so on. So the typing pool example was meant to illustrate a case where there is a network effect, but no network externality, because the decision maker, the manager of the typing pool, is taking into account the full benefits and costs of each individual typist's action. Okay? We've talked for several weeks about this notion of tipping, that when network effects are present, you might get the market to sort of converge on one standard or another, and that convergence may be very sudden, it may be discontinuous, it may be, according to some scholars, the result of relatively minor, even seemingly random events, right? And we talked about many examples of tipping in terms of standards and platforms for hardware and software, language, of course, the monetary unit. Those are also examples where the market might, you know, have multiple kinds of commodity money in play, but very quickly one will get a head start and then the market will sort of tip in favor of that one commodity until it is the dominant standard in the market. From this follows the notion of path dependence, the idea that when network effects are present, we may over time find ourselves engaged in a particular behavior, using a particular networked standard, having adopted one technology or another, choices that we regret. In other words, not because the action we're taking or the platform or standard that we use or the technology we employ is the best, not because it's the one we would have chosen if we could do it all over again, but because we're stuck. We made a decision in the past, maybe a bad decision, maybe the result of a coin flip, and now here we are stuck going down this one particular path, and we can't turn around and go back even if we wanted to. The other theme, or one of the other themes we've emphasized throughout the whole course, is this notion that, you know, what appears to be new is not necessarily brand new. And the examples of money and the common law and language and so on illustrate that these network phenomena are hardly, you know, something of the 20th century, right, but have been going on as long as, you know, human civilization itself. Now, how do all of these things apply to the internet? Oh, whoops, I'm sorry. I accidentally jumped to the very last slide. I hit the wrong button. Here we go. You know, why discuss the internet in particular in this context? Why devote an entire week and some separate readings just to the internet and the analysis of the internet, the economics of the internet? Well, I mean, we could think of a number of reasons, right? Electronic commerce through the internet is today the primary, you know, venue or marketplace in which the exchange of information goods takes place. Now, that certainly wasn't always the case, right? If we think of a catalog, a mail order catalog as an information good, then these catalogs could be purchased in a store, they could be purchased over the telephone, through the mail, right? Anytime a business hires a consultant or someone wishing to buy a house hires an architect, you know, they're participating in an information goods market, hiring somebody for their knowledge, for their expertise, for the information they're about to provide. And those markets, of course, have existed for decades and centuries without any internet, right? But many of the information goods that we think about purchasing today or consuming today, like a Google search or access to Facebook or a book from the Amazon Kindle store or whatever, these transactions typically take place, you know, within the overall structure of the internet. The internet provides a great laboratory for analysis and a wonderful set of illustrations of some of these network effect and network externality contexts or examples or issues that we've been talking about. The role of standards, such as the, you know, standard for http://, right? HTML code represents a standard. And if each computer programmer, each website designer used his own personal, individualized, random code to program a web page, well, then there wouldn't be any point to it, right? No one other than that designer, him or herself, would be able to render the page on the browser, but were to read the web page, right? It only makes sense if there are shared standards, if there is a programming language that all different browsers understand. And of course, those of you know, if any of you are those of you who are web designers or you know, other people who deal with HTML, know that, you know, 80%, maybe 90% of HTML is standardized across platforms, across browsers, and so on. But there are some quirks, right? Web designers know that when they design a page, they need to check it on Internet Explorer, they need to check it on Firefox, they need to check it on Chrome or Opera or whatever, and make sure that it looks the same on all browsers. Because, you know, especially when you get into fancier features and scripting and so on, there are subtle differences in the HTML that is recognized by different browsers that works with different servers and so on. So there's not 100% compliance in that sense. But there has to be at least a high degree of standardization among, you know, what languages the browsers can understand, what kind of information commands a computer can process. Otherwise, there's no point to trying to share information, you know, over common protocols, right? So this notion of how important it is to have common standards and how, as a result, we may get locked into using standards that we don't really like, right? And then the internet provides a very neat and clean illustration of these kinds of concepts. And, you know, of course, it's sort of the flagship new economy product, output, activity. I couldn't think of exactly the right word, so I put on my slide that the internet is the flagship new economy thing, right? When you think of the term new economy or the networked economy, you know, what people think about almost instinctively is the internet. I don't want to bore you with a lot of historical details. I mean, I provide a very brief sketch in my article on Mises.org that you have for reading this week. You know, if you're interested, there are lots and lots of websites you can go to get information, different people's perspectives, interviews with key figures. I mean, even the Wikipedia entry on the history of the internet is not bad. We don't need to go into all of the detail, but it is worth going through kind of a few basic facts just to remind ourselves, you know, about kind of the internet's basic origins and early functions and in a very rough and ready sense, how it came to be what it is today. Well, I mean, everybody knows that the internet, you know, did not emerge out of, you know, sort of the for-profit sector. It wasn't Microsoft or Apple or Google, you know, that created the internet. It was a bunch of government agencies and government funded researchers at public universities, right, or semi-public universities like Stanford. You all know about the so-called ARPANET, right? ARPA, which stands for Advanced Research Projects Agency, was a defense, still exists. ARPA was a defense, U.S. Defense Department agency, which was formed in the 1950s, you know, after the Russians were the first to get a satellite into orbit with their Sputnik program. You know, the U.S. raced into high gear to match it. And so, you know, huge amounts of money were being poured into scientific and technical projects for military use. And this organization called ARPA was responsible for managing and coordinating a lot of these projects. And ARPA came up with the idea of a particular kind of communication network. We'll talk in just a few moments about what's how that network would work and what functions it would serve. But that's sort of, you know, the fundamental point is that, you know, the internet was originally a government-sponsored military defense project. The original purpose of, you know, linking these different machines together in this particular way to allow them to communicate was not for civilian or scientific or academic or commercial use, but it was purely a military use, paid for with public dollars, tax dollars, and so on, you know, with sort of national military objectives in mind. Many of you know, the RAND Corporation, which is a quasi-public, quasi-private sort of think tank that's based in Santa Monica, California, was originally part of the Air Force and then split off in the 1960s, or late 1950s, I guess, to have a little bit more independence. The RAND Corporation, researchers at the RAND Corporation, like Paul Baran, were instrumental in doing a lot of the background work for the sort of technical aspects of linking a number of computers together, using the kind of protocols that we now understand as internet communication. The famous article by Paul Baran and some co-authors in 1964 was the first to kind of specify what this network would look like, what attributes it should have, how it might function, and so on. I'll come back to Paul Baran in just a moment. But the key thing to remember is that the RAND Corporation was, you know, 100% funded by government contracts. And these researchers, many of them were civilian researchers, professors, a lot of famous economists in those days were involved with RAND. You know, RAND was the big center of Cold War. A lot of the research and thinking was going on at RAND. Those of you who, if you've seen the movie Dr. Strangelove, which is one of my favorites, if you haven't ever seen it, I highly recommend it. It takes place during that era, and there are many not so subtle references to the kind of research that was going on at RAND. In the movie, they call it the Bland Corporation, and the crazy scientist whose name is Dr. Strangelove was reputedly by the director Stanley Kubrick modeled after Herbert Kahn, who was a RAND Corporation military strategist. Other important institutions were research universities in the West Coast, Stanford in particular, also UCLA and USC, Caltech. An article that he and some co-authors produced in the 1970s laying out the theory of what's called TCP/IP, Transmission Control Protocol / Internet Protocol. So even those of you who are not techies, you heard the letters IP because we talk about IP addresses. Oh, sorry, Danny is telling me we lost something. Sorry, how far should I go back, Danny? Where did I freeze up? Okay. Was I talking about the different universities, I guess, Stanford and other universities in the West Coast that did a lot of the research for the TCP/IP protocol. And as I was saying, even those of you who are not techies, you've heard the letters IP because you know, everybody knows what an IP address is. If you've ever tried to set up your internet connection at home, that set of four sets of three digits that corresponds to your internet address. And as we said last time, they're trying to expand that to what's called IP6 to have even more numbers available. Anyway, the point is the sort of specifications for how a machine communicates to another machine that is designated by an address in virtual space, this IP address, that those specifications were designed by Cerf and other researchers at Stanford in the 1970s. Many other universities and public sort of government think tanks, MIT, University of Illinois, what's called the National Center for Superconducting Applications, NCSA, was a major researcher in the early days of the web browser. And in fact, the first sort of widely used web browser, some of the old timers may remember NCSA Mosaic, which was a product of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Also CERN, or CERN as it's sometimes called, which is a government-funded research institution in Switzerland, was the first. CERN was where actually the first functional browser was tested. Another famous guy named Tim Berners-Lee is credited, MIT professor, is credited for having created the first workable browser that could render a page on HTTP. So these are names that you may recognize, people that you may have seen before. What were they working on? When the ARPA researchers began thinking about these problems in the 1960s, their main objective, or at least one of the main objectives, was to find a way to allow different, military bases, commanders, and so on, to communicate in the event of a nuclear war, right? So this was the Cold War era. It was thought that the Russians might launch a nuclear bomb against, on U.S. soil. What would happen if, the commanders in, the Pentagon were cut off from, let's say, an Air Force base in Wyoming, NORAD. NORAD's out in Wyoming, Pentagon's in Washington, D.C. If there's one line, if there's sort of one long wire that's laid from Wyoming to Washington, D.C., and a bomb goes off in the middle of it, that wire is cut. And now the two bases, the base and the Pentagon, can't communicate with each other. Well, Paul Baran had this idea that you could create a network consisting of a series of nodes, each of which could communicate with the others. Right, so this diagram that you see on the slide, this is from Paul Baran's famous 1964 paper. He sketched out in this picture three different types of networks. The one on the left he called a centralized network, the one in the middle one a decentralized network, and the one on the right a distributed network, right? So a centralized network is one with, with one central node. Every outlying, dot, every node on the network, you go through the center and then back out again to reach another node. To get from one node to another, you all have to pass through the center. And, you might recognize this as the FedEx model, right? This worked great for Fred Smith and Federal Express because it allowed him to centralize the sorting in one location in Memphis, right? So you ship all the cargo into Memphis, you sort it, put it back on the right planes, and ship it back out to its destination. That's highly economically efficient for shipping packages. Because the major cost in a package delivery system, again, is the sorting, right? So, yeah, in principle, it takes more fuel if you're sending a package from New York to Boston to go New York to Memphis, Memphis to Boston, right? But it, but those costs are more than made up for by the reduced cost of sorting the packages, all of which takes place in one central location, taking advantage of massive economies of scale, right? Now, so a centralized network is great for FedEx, but you can see, obviously, this would not be a good design for a military network, because if the enemy knows where that central node is, all they got to do is take out that central node, and the whole network falls apart. You know, maybe we could call this the fate of the original Napster, right? The original Napster that was shut down by the feds, not the thing that they call Napster today, but the original Napster, the first peer-to-peer file sharing system, was stopped because the recording industry of America could and did sue the company and have and have the courts order that the central node be shut down, and the whole thing fell apart. Well, if you don't want to be dependent on a central node, you want either a decentralized, well, some more decentralized kind of solution, right? So a decentralized network is one with multiple sort of central nodes, the picture in the middle, right? So that is sort of it gives you some of the advantages of centralization. You do have some central coordination that takes place in these main nodes, but you're less vulnerable to having, there's not one critical node that if it gets taken out, the whole thing falls apart. But you can see that even with this decentralized network, there are some vulnerable spots. And Baran made the point that, look, what if you had a so-called distributed network in which, you know, every node or almost every node was connected to every other node, or each node was connected to more than one alternative node. So there were no, in this kind of network, there are no central nodes at all, right? There are no critical nodes that could be taken out and cause the collapse of the system. So Baran's idea was, if the military could set up a distributed network, then it would always be possible for one part of the network to communicate with any other. You know, if the central part of that web were to be taken out, traffic could simply be routed around the web, around the hole, so that you can always get from point A to point B, almost always, okay? So you can see how this structure provides a much more stable kind of solution if you're worried about the, you know, security of the physical infrastructure. Right now, how is that going to work? Well, you have to have a system by which when the nodes, if one node wants to communicate with another node, it sends out some little pieces of information, and there has to be some protocol by which the next node that receives them knows kind of which direction to send them out, right? So each node needs to be aware of what other nodes are around it. If the nodes around it are functional, right, if they're responding to signals and so on, and then which way to send the information that it's just received. And if you think about it, it doesn't require a whole lot of intelligence on the part of these individual nodes. I mean, they can be pretty dumb. In fact, basically, they can just sort of, whenever they receive packets, they can check around the packets of information. They can check around them to see, okay, what nodes are near me and are online, and I can just send the little bits to whichever nodes are near me and online. And as long as each little bit of information is marked or tagged with its final destination, eventually it's possible for all these little packets to be routed to their final resting place, okay? And that's exactly the way the internet protocol works. Something else that's critical to this, I think I forgot to write it down on my slide, is the notion of packets. Let me go back to the picture, right? So when you send data into the internet, it's not one long continuous stream of information. It's broken up into these little pieces called packets. And the idea is that, you know, the packets don't all have to travel together like a freight train. Rather, they can be split off. One packet can go this way and another packet can go that way. And as long as it's fast enough, once the packets are received, they can be reassembled into their proper order and, you know, sort of decoded, right? And when you're doing streaming audio or video, or, you know, you're chatting on Skype, you're browsing the web, That's exactly what's happening, right? Your voice or your picture is being broken up into little pieces, which all then shoot out over to the network. I'm live connection. But, you know, as all of us know, sometimes it doesn't work perfectly, especially for high bandwidth applications. So when you see stuttering and if the video freezes or you hear some funny sounds in the background, you know, or the video picture begins to pixelate. If you have digital cable, which I do, most of you probably have digital rather than analog cable, you know, sometimes you can see the picture begins to pixelate a little bit. You see these little blocks where you should see, you know, where you should see a smooth picture. That's because the information that's coming in is missing a few pieces, and the computer inside your cable box is trying to reassemble those packets as quickly as it can, but they're not coming in quite fast enough. Okay, so a distributed network combined with this sort of packet switching protocol and some algorithms for switching or sending the packets across different switches or routers makes for a pretty neat way of communicating across a large number of nodes over a great distance. So you need, besides the distributed network, you know, a simple and straightforward system of addresses, something like domain name servers that convert what people type into their browsers, like Microsoft.com, into an IP address, and then, you know, sends the data where it needs to go. Those things are all necessary to achieve the military objectives that were set out by the RAND Corporation researchers like Paul Barrett. Okay. Again, the goal was not commercial. It was not sort of scientific. It was not educational. It was to ensure that the different parts of the military network could always be in communication, even in the event of a nuclear war. Now, whether that is a worthy objective or not is a separate issue, right? So, you know, you don't have to take any particular position on whether it was, you know, whether it's good to have that kind of a military network or what Cold War policy should have been. That doesn't matter for our purposes. The point is simply that the basic sort of guts of the internet were designed by specific people with a specific purpose in mind, namely military communication in the event of a nuclear war. Now, one of the sort of side benefits of this distributed network, the notion of putting information in packets and moving the packets across various switches and so on, is that it also provides a pretty efficient way for people to share fixed computing resources. Now remember, in the 1950s and 1960s, you know, a computer was not something that could sit on a desktop. Computers were these giant behemoths that filled up entire rooms. They were extremely expensive. You know, the Defense Department had a few, and research universities might have one. Large companies might have a computer, but that was about it. They were extremely expensive. And they were not really used to their full capacity, right? A lot of the time, the huge box is just sitting there. So it made sense to come up with ways for lots of users to share the computer. If any of you are as old as me or older, you might remember, you know, a long time ago when you would sit at a sort of a teletype and you would type in some instructions on a screen, and the instructions would go off to the central processor, which might be in the next room, or it might be 100 miles away, the instructions would be processed and then output would be sent back to you. Maybe the input was, maybe the medium or language for the input, the medium was punch cards instead of typing on a keyboard. And maybe what came back was some kind of a hard copy on an old sort of dot matrix printer or a daisy wheel printer. You know, it's funny, there's so much, you know, buzz now about the cloud. I'm really kind of actually sick of hearing the term cloud, the sense of cloud computing. But I think it's funny how things kind of cycle around. So when I was, I guess when I was in high school, college, late 70s, early 80s, the kind of PCs that you could, computers that you could put on your desk were, kind of fancy toys. The Apple II or the Commodore 64, even the original IBM PC, they just couldn't do very much. They couldn't handle large amounts of data. They couldn't process information very fast. So all serious research computing, statistical analysis that researchers would do at a university, what statisticians would work on, weather forecasting, big companies doing marketing research. I mean, none of that could be done on a desktop machine. You needed a powerful mainframe computer to be able to process, to do serious data processing. So desktop computers were useful for, typing a letter and maybe, operating a very, very small spreadsheet or something like that. But serious quantitative analysis had to be done on a mainframe. The term that they used in those days was the client-server model. So what you would have sitting on your desk is a keyboard and a screen that didn't have much in the way of guts, right? A so-called dumb terminal, which would be connected through the internet to a server somewhere else that would do the actual computing. You would sort of log into the server. Maybe you'd have a little window. Some of you might remember Telnet was a program that you could use on a monochrome screen to remotely connect to a mainframe computer and, execute a job or run a program on the mainframe computer. That client-server model was what everybody used when I was doing my dissertation research in the late 80s, early 90s. I used a mainframe computer because PCs just really weren't good enough to handle, even medium-sized data sets. What I thought was interesting in the 1990s is in the early 2000s, as personal computers became more powerful, right, as processing power increased dramatically, storage space, the cost of these components fell. I mean, I can almost remember, the specific year when for the same amount of money you could buy a PC to sit at your desk from Dell or something that was just as powerful as the mainframe. So for the same amount of money it would cost you to get, mainframe access and some kind of a dumb terminal, you could now get a PC that would actually do the computing locally on your desk. And everyone talked about how the client-server model was dead. Advances in hardware and software had rendered the client-server model obsolete. Well, what do we have now? Now the movement is toward smaller devices, thin and light clients, mobile apps, handhelds, tablets, netbooks, and so on that are not as powerful as people want to do all the things they want to do and don't have a lot of local storage capacity. But you keep all your data on the cloud, right? You use an iPad or some little tablet. You're running, Google Docs, and web browsing. So unlike the old days, like 3 years ago, when you would have a powerful laptop with Windows on it and Microsoft Word and Microsoft Excel and so on, now you just need a very thin and light client that has a web browser. All you need is a web browser. You do all your computing on the cloud. That's in many ways, we've gone full circle back to the old client-server model. Anyway, the point is, if you can't do all the computing that you need locally, if you have to be able to log into a remote machine, or you want to be able to store your data in a, someplace on the network where you can access it from multiple locations, then it makes sense to have some kind of a system for sharing computer resources, right? One of the beauties of this packet switching technology is that multiple packets can sort of share the line. Right? Think about a railroad line. So imagine that I'm here in Columbia, Missouri, and let's say I want to communicate with the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Imagine that I just pick up an old-fashioned telephone and I call Jeff Tucker at the Mises Institute. Now imagine that we're little kids and we have one of those tin can telephones, two cans connected by a piece of string. An old-fashioned telephone connection would be like that. In other words, as soon as I dial Jeff's number and he picks up, we would then have a dedicated line allocated just to us. So one wire, you know, going through multiple switches and so on, but one telephone line, one circuit would be completely allocated just to our conversation. And the problem with that is that might be a pretty inefficient way to allocate circuit space, because a lot of our conversation might be, what if Jeff and I are having a fight and there are long periods of awkward silence? Well, that circuit is being wasted when nobody's talking on it. You know, then maybe there's somebody else in St. Louis who wants to talk to somebody in Atlanta, and in principle, they could share a large part of our circuit, but it's closed to them. It's blocked off because we have it reserved. Jeff and I have it reserved for the full duration of our conversation. Contrast that to a distributed network with packet switching, right? When Jeff and I talk, right, I say something into the line, my voice is, you know, transmitted and converted into ones and zeros and broken into packets and sent out onto that circuit, but lots of other users are sharing the same circuit. All our packets are getting mixed together. So that circuit is constantly being used. There are always packets flowing down that line. They're just not necessarily mine. They belong to multiple users. And eventually they're all, you know, they're all routed to where they need to go and they get reassembled. And when Jeff hears my voice, he hears my, it's just as if we had a dedicated line. But in fact, it's we're sharing a resource. All those of us who are communicating on that part of the network are using the same wires, the same circuits, right? If bandwidth is scarce, that is a more effective way of utilizing the full capacity of that bandwidth. There's no wasted capacity. So in principle, you don't need as many lines if people can share them than you do if everyone has to be able to have their own dedicated line, okay? So that's another reason why the internet technology tended to be very useful for military and civilian researchers back in the 60s, let's say, who were using projects that required a mainframe computer. Again, keep in mind how important it is here to have common standards, right? And a way to identify nodes, protocols for, you know, directing different pieces of information in different ways, in different directions, and specifying how they will connect to a particular piece of hardware, right? So the so-called transfer protocols like FTP. It used to be everybody knew what FTP was because you'd say, well, I'm going to go download some files from a server somewhere. I think I'll just FTP them to my own machine. Right now, file transfers are all done through HTTP, Hypertext Transfer Protocol, web browsing, in other words. So nobody knows what FTP is anymore. Telnet is pretty much dead too. But these are all different protocols for specifying how one machine talks to another machine. And you need standards that are, you know, that are open and published and easy for everyone to access to make this kind of thing work. Some funny pictures. I showed you this one a couple weeks ago. And this is what the ARPANET looked like circa 1972. I think there were about 25 or 30 nodes around that time. And as you can see, there are some nodes out in California. You can see Stanford, UCLA, UC Santa Barbara, the RAND Corporation, and so on. Somebody in Salt Lake City, I guess, had a node. Maybe that's the University of Utah. You can see the University of Illinois smack there in the middle of the country, although I think this map is not very accurate because Carnegie Mellon should be much lower than that. That's in Pittsburgh. And you have a Case Western University in Cleveland. That doesn't look like it's in the right point of the map anyway. And then you got a bunch of places on the East Coast. You got the MIT and some other places in the Boston area, et cetera. I mean, that was it, right? These were the nodes on the internet in the early 1970s. And, you know, so you can see it wasn't, it was really sort of a highly experimental network at this point. It certainly wasn't blanketing the U.S. with this distributed network that Paul Baran envisioned, But at least around this time, kind of the idea for how to make it work, the technology necessary to make it work was pretty much in place. But how did we get from that to what we have today? Well, it took quite a few years, but what people quickly realized within the ARPA and ARPANET communities was that this technology, this ARPANET technology, was a really, really good way to write letters back and forth. It was a really good way to have essentially chat and email. Some of you might remember the old Unix Talk protocol, which is sort of an early instant message chat program. But the ability to chat and to send email, newsletters, and so on, quickly and efficiently to large numbers of people, eventually became the sort of the major use of this network. And over time, parts of the network were opened up to non-military use, parts were declassified, and were opened up to other networks. So any network right, so basically the ARPANET began to grow into this sort of network of networks where lots and lots of smaller local and regional networks were hooked up together until they all eventually became this one sort of big sort of seamless thing. Yeah, I forgot exactly what I was saying, Danny. I guess I was saying, any network that speaks the TCP/IP language, any network that has routers and switches that understand TCP/IP can be connected to the ARPANET and thus become a part of this larger network of networks. Okay, so within a decade or two, you had the beginnings of sort of the private internet. By the late 80s, early 90s, almost every university, every university network could speak TCP/IP and was connected to the internet, so anybody with an email address could communicate with anybody else who had an email address. I remember exactly, I got my first email account in 1989, and I was a graduate student, and I knew a few other graduate students who had email accounts, email addresses, and we could send little notes back and forth, and that was pretty much it. Now, kind of what they call the backbone or trunk lines continued to be owned by the Defense Department and financed by the Defense Department for quite a while until 1984. Then the U.S. National Science Foundation financed and owned and operated and financed the trunk lines until 1994. And then they were sold off to private telecom companies and so on. So, even as late as the mid-90s, very important parts of the network were owned and operated by the U.S. government. You can see a picture of what an old-timey web page looked like on my slide there. I remember those from the early days of NCSA Mosaic. So that must have been late 80s or early 90s. Okay, this little historical detour is fun and interesting. Why am I telling you all this? Who cares? What's the point? Well, there are a number of important economic issues for us, right? One obvious one has to do with pricing. So if I want to communicate with somebody over the internet, if I want to send a message using the TCP/IP protocol, well, it's using some physical scarce resources, right? A computer, computing power, several different switches or routers, there are wires, there's electricity, maintenance and so on. Somebody's got to pay for that. Who's going to pay for it? Well, the standard model has been, the marginal cost of transmitting a little packet of information is almost zero. It's so close to zero that it doesn't make sense to charge people for internet use you know, according to how much data they use, how many packets they send, you know, for the typical user. So it's probably more effective to have some kind of a flat rate pricing scheme, right? So you purchase a server or server space, and as long as you have a server, you can send as much stuff into onto the network as possible. For a long time, and I'd say probably until the last 5 or 10 years, that almost everybody believed that internet bandwidth was basically unlimited, that bandwidth was not a scarce resource in the economist's, you know, notion of scarcity, namely that there isn't enough to satisfy everyone. No, it was said, you know, bandwidth is basically a free good, like air. That's what people said. Now, they're not saying that so much anymore, you know, especially as a lot of internet traffic moves into the wireless spectrum. And if any of you guys purchased an iPhone from Verizon, you know, one of the big stories that was hitting the wire, the news wires last week was that Verizon, you know, they changed the fine print of the customer agreement, giving them the right to limit your data usage if you exceed some threshold. So very heavy users of Verizon's network, their use would be metered. Verizon might cut you off. And of course, a lot of you have cell phone plans, mobile phone plans, maybe even your internet plan at home that limits your speed or restricts the amount of data that you can send, or maybe even charges you a price as a function of how much data you transmit. Most of us have unlimited calling plans and data plans on our phones, but you know, if you roam outside of your home country, I mean, I've gotten some startlingly high cell phone bills sometimes when I'm, you know, if I've been traveling overseas, because I sometimes forget that, you know, they're not only voice charges, voice roaming charges, but data roaming charges. And if you have a smartphone that is doing a lot of things in the background, you know, checking your stock ticker and your horoscope and the weather report and so on without you really being aware of it, that's using bandwidth. And if you're getting charged, you know, so many cents per byte when you're outside of your home country, that can really add up. Why is this important? Well, there is such a thing as network congestion. We all know this, right? I mean, the network's not congested all the time, but there are plenty of times when you've been sitting impatiently drumming your fingers, waiting for a web page to load. Every time you make a Skype call, it's not perfect. Sometimes it sounds pretty good, sometimes it's horrible. You have to hang up. So there isn't quite enough bandwidth for everybody to literally use as much as they want without it affecting somebody else. There is some scarcity of bandwidth resources. And people say, yeah, but you know, fiber optic cable can carry this many gazillion bytes of information. Fine, but you still have routers and switches and other kind of choke points that are somewhat limited in the amount of traffic that they can handle. Now, anytime you have a scarce resource that is offered to users at a zero price, what's going to happen? Well, you'll have overuse. What the sociologist Garrett Hardin famously called the tragedy of the commons. Right, so the claim is because internet bandwidth is not metered or priced for most users, it tends to be overutilized. Right, we upload and download huge files, we have streaming video chat sessions with our friends and so on, without any thought whatsoever to how that might be affecting other users, whether that might clog up the internet, whether that might slow down somebody else, because we you know, it doesn't cost anything. Costs no more to upload a big file than it does a small file in most cases, so we just don't think about it. But it's not at all obvious that that's the right way to price internet use, right? I mean, in principle, the operator of the router or the trunk line could charge each user, you know, so many pennies, so many cents or fractions of a cent to send each packet onto the stream. I mean, imagine it's like a private turnpike, a toll road with toll gates and toll bridges. You want to use the road, you have to pay something for it. Now, when you talk about toll roads and toll booths on a regular highway road, but people would always say, well, we raise a number of objections. Well, that's very cumbersome because you always have to stop and pay a toll. Well, that objection is technologically obsolete, right? Because you can have a smart card and a scanner and the car can just zoom right on by through the toll booth and still get recorded and charged by the private road operator. People say, well, yeah, but it's not fair. That's not fair because you might be too poor to be able to afford to get on the highway. And so, rich people can drive as much as they want because they can afford the tolls, but poor people are limited in how much they can drive. Well, I mean, look, that's an interesting objection, but, the standard economist response would be to say, if you're concerned that some people can't afford to use the highway, and you think it's important that they be able to use the highway, then the best way to handle that is through philanthropy, private charity, or other means to sort of increase those people's purchasing power, to give them cash or give them coupons that they can use to pay the toll, but not to eliminate the toll or to have the government control the price of the toll. Why? Because there are a lot of times when even a rich person might drive down the street, not because it's really important, not because he really needs to, but just for the heck of it. It's a joyride, right? I mean, think about what happens when you're driving down the street and an ambulance or a fire engine comes up behind you, right? In most countries, by law, you're supposed to pull over to the side of the road to let that ambulance or fire truck through, lights flashing and sirens blaring, right? Now, that's a case where, society, so to speak, has determined that at that moment, the highest priority use of that road is to get the ambulance or the fire engine through. You who's just on your way to work or on your way to the movies, on your way to the grocery store, your need to be on the road at that moment is less urgent than the ambulance or the fire engine's need. So you have to make way and let somebody else go in front of you, okay? But if you think about it, right, I mean, every person who's driving down the road has a different sort of urgency or need to be on the road at that moment. It's not just emergency vehicles, right? I mean, I'm late for work. I've got an important meeting. I've got to get through. And you're driving down the road, just listening to the radio, trying to, you just had an argument with your significant other, and you just want to drive around a little bit to clear your head. Well, whose use of the road is more important? Well, probably me trying to get to work for that important meeting. In a sense that you really wouldn't even care. You'd be happy to get off the road and let me go in front of you. But unless I have a siren or a flashing light, there's really no way for me to signal for you to get the heck out of the way and let me get past. What if we all had to pay for each mile that we drove? And what if there were different prices based on times of day, based on circumstances, based on any number of things, right? Maybe think about a set of toll booths where you have, let's say there's 10 different lanes that you can go through. There's a $10 lane, a $9 lane, an $8 lane, and so on, down to a $1 lane. You think, well, that sounds weird. I mean, then, the rich people would all be in one lane and the poor people in another lane. No, that would be a way of sort of deciding who gets through the toll booth first according to willingness to pay. Right, so most people wouldn't want to pay 10 bucks to get through, and so they'd get in the $1 line or the $2 line or maybe the $3 line. But if my wife's about to go into labor and I'm rushing to get to the hospital, I would gladly pay 10 bucks to go to the more expensive line if it's shorter and I can get through faster. Right, so you can imagine allocating the scarce resource of getting through the toll booth according to willingness to pay. And we can think of a lot of reasons why that would be a very effective or very efficient means of allocating that scarce resource. You say, well, that's not fair. What if you're poor? But look, if there's only a certain number of lanes and that isn't enough to accommodate every car where it can just zoom right through, somebody's got to be stopped and waiting in line, right? How do you allocate space through the toll booth? First come, first served? Who's willing to wait the longest? who the government says ought to get through. I mean, that's not a, those are not particularly desirable allocation mechanisms either. There's lots and lots of theory and evidence suggesting that allowing people to demonstrate, you know, how much they value the scarce good or service by voting with their dollars, right, through expressing a willingness to pay, is the most effective, most efficient way of allocating any scarce resource. So why not treat the information superhighway the same way? Right? The technology of it is very straightforward. There's been a lot of analysis or research on this. You could have a system where, you know, when you send an email or you launch a video session or whatever, each time you send a packet out into the network, when it gets to the first router, when you send your packets out into the packet stream, each packet has attached to it a bid, a number, right, that your some algorithm on your computer would allocate the, would assign those bids according to some information you've specified in advance, so you don't have to do it manually every time. And then whenever the packets get to a router, it performs a little auction, and whichever packets have the highest bids on them get to go through first. And it keeps track of this, and then it bills backward right to the sender, and you get a monthly bill or something according to how many packets you sent. And how much you pay depends on what you're, you know, whether you were the winning bidder, in a sense, the highest bidder in that particular little teeny tiny real-time auction. There are any number of schemes for prioritizing the packets based on willingness to pay. And again, it can all be automatic and fully transparent to the user, invisible to the user. You just get a monthly bill that says, well, you know, you sent this many high priority packets through and this many low priority packets through and so on. I mean, there are any number of creative schemes that entrepreneurs, if left to their own devices, could come up with for allocating scarce internet bandwidth. However, the current TCP/IP protocol does not permit this kind of pricing system. It's egalitarian. A router using TCP/IP lets all packets through. Nobody was thinking that there would be so many users. Nobody thought bandwidth would be scarce in this sense. It didn't occur to anyone to build in features for allowing some kind of pricing or other scheme for prioritizing packets. So we're stuck with a system in which there is no way to give some people, you know, the first rights through the network. Even if I, you know, say I'm a surgeon and I'm saying the current setup is designed in such a way that it is impossible to have this kind of priority system. We're stuck with the protocols that were designed in the 1960s and 70s by government-funded scientists and researchers who had, you know, no inkling whatsoever about what the internet would turn out to be. Like, suppose that I'm a surgeon, I'm in the middle of surgery, and I've run into a horrible complication, and there's some expert, you know, on the other side of the globe in this one particular procedure that I want to perform. If I could just get him on the line, you know, in a real-time video chat, he could help me with the surgery, and maybe we could save somebody's life. But oops, you know, I can't get through, my packets can't get through fast enough because somebody else is using the scarce bandwidth, you know, to watch funny videos on Failblog or something, or somebody else is goofing around on YouTube. Unfortunately, the way the network is designed, there is no way for the high priority packets to get through. I'm going to pause for just a moment because my computer has frozen up. I don't know if you can still hear me. Hopefully it will come back in just a second. Okay. Danny, did you lose me for a minute there? Oh, okay, good, fantastic. Okay, there's just a problem with my screen. Anyway, so this is a case where the things we would like to be able to do with the network that we cannot do because of the way it was designed. And the people who designed it were not profit-seeking entrepreneurs, right? They were government officials, or they were government-funded scientists who had completely different objectives in mind. You know, look, of course, this isn't to say that, you know, the internet that we have today is completely 100% shaped by, determined by, restricted by the protocols that were designed 30, 40 years ago, only to say that those protocols do continue to play a significant role. And maybe things could have been different. So, I point out in the articles, I think, you know, Bastiat's famous broken window fallacy, popularized by Henry Hazlitt, is highly relevant here. We love the internet, the internet's great, but is the internet that we have today, is that the best of all conceivable internets? Well, I don't know. I mean, nobody knows for sure, right, what kind of a global high-speed communications network might we have today if the designers of the internet had been private entrepreneurs rather than government officials and government-funded researchers and scientists. I mean, there were other kinds of networks before the internet. There were pre-internet or non-TCP IP kinds of networks. Some of you might remember the old dial-up bulletin boards. This one called textfiles.com was founded in 1978. Anybody with a computer hooked up to an old-fashioned modem could dial into a certain set of phone numbers and could upload and download files using different protocols, not using TCP/IP. There were the old networks like America Online, AOL, or CompuServe that had news and games and shopping and so on. They had a kind of email, but the early AOL and CompuServe, they were completely self-contained networks. So if you had an AOL email address, you could only send email to other people on the AOL network. It wasn't an internet email address. Same thing with CompuServe. You could do things within these networks. They used different kinds of communications protocols. Some of them did not use anything like TCP/IP. Most of them had some kind of packet switching, but not necessarily, and there are different kinds of packet switching and so on. You know, who's to say that one of these might not have morphed or evolved into something like the internet if the government-funded, government-sponsored, government-created internet had not been there instead? You know, and again, from the point of view of the broken window fallacy, think of the, you know, billions and billions, maybe trillions of dollars that were siphoned away from the private sector through taxes and given to people at the RAND Corporation and UCLA and the Defense Department and so on, to play with computers and to play with switches. Had those resources remained in the private sector, we would be wealthier. The private sector would have had more funding available for R&D and maybe would have come up with something that's much better than the internet we have today. We simply will never know, right? So the idea with the broken window fallacy is the fact that government spending led to some product doesn't mean that if it hadn't been for the government spending, we wouldn't have had the product or wouldn't have had a similar product or a better product. We may very well have had one. I find this quote, I think it's in the article too, fascinating, from something called the Netbook, which bills itself as sort of an unofficial history of the internet. You can look at the URL there. One of the points that this document emphasizes is how non-commercial, non-market-oriented, non-profit-seeking the internet's designers were. And of course, the authors of the Netbook take this as You know, the reason why the internet is so great. It's not one of those yucky, icky, greedy, grubby, for-profit things. It was a non-profit, academic, military research thing, and that's what makes it so great, in their view, right? They say, quote, the current global computer network has been developed by scientists and researchers and users who were free of market forces. You get that? You know, thank goodness they were free of those ugly market forces. Because of the government oversight and subsidy of network development, these network pioneers were not under the time pressures or bottom line restraints that dominate commercial ventures. Therefore, they could contribute the time and labor needed to make sure the problems were solved. In other words, because they were spending other people's money without any requirement to produce goods or services that consumers wanted, they could basically do whatever the hell they wanted. And it turned out to be kind of neat from a certain point of view, right? That's my translation. You can see the sort of inherent anti-commercial, anti-market bias that's involved in this kind of story. Now, why is this important? I've gotten myself in trouble with some of my free market colleagues in the past on this very point. Some people, like former Vice President Al Gore, are famous or infamous for taking credit for playing a strong role in the development of the internet. Everybody jokes that Al Gore claims he invented the internet. I mean, to be fair to former Vice President Gore, he didn't exactly say that. He kind of implied it, or other people implied it, but he did point out that when he was in the Senate, he was responsible for a lot of legislation that dumped a whole bunch of money on the NSF and so on to get them to do internet work. Fine. But people like Al Gore and his supporters say, this is a perfect example of why you need the government to do R&D, why the government needs to do the research. Look at the internet. Isn't that a great example of successful government innovation? And a lot of free market economists, they say, well, no, that can't be right. The government really played a pretty small role in the internet. The internet is largely a market creation. It's an example of spontaneous order. It's proof that you don't need the government to do anything. The internet is fantastic and it's great because it is really so private. Well, my position is somewhat different from both of those, right? I mean, I agree with Al Gore that the government did play a big role, but I disagree with Al Gore that that role was good. In other words, I think the internet we have is okay, but if it hadn't been for the government, the internet we have would be a lot better. So I think it's wrong for free market proponents to sort of dismiss the government role and say, no, the government really didn't have anything to do with it. This is the glory of the market and the wonder of spontaneous order, manifest in the internet. I think that view is wrong too. I think we should acknowledge the huge influence, the path-dependent nature of the government-created technologies and standards, and how those, in a sense, constrain the effectiveness of the internet today, and use that as an example of why the government should not be doing R&D, why we should not have government-sponsored innovation, but rather innovation coming from the market. Okay, so, again, to conclude, is the internet an example of market-driven, emergent, bottom-up, spontaneous order? A little, but not completely, right? Public funding, public administration played a huge role, not necessarily for the good. The key decision makers in the early stages, whose decisions still have effects today, were not motivated by satisfying consumer wants, as an entrepreneur would be motivated, but were solely motivated by their own research objectives, the government's objectives, and so on. We always want to evaluate the effectiveness, economic effectiveness of a technology based on its economic value to consumers. And it doesn't matter how mathematically elegant a switching algorithm is, if it doesn't allow consumers to use the technology the way they want, to do the things they want, then it's not the right technology. In when I teach this, talk about this subject at Mises University, I used to get a lot of questions about open source software. People would say, you know, don't you think open source is a more free market, spontaneous order kind of thing? And isn't proprietary software bad? Or isn't proprietary software like central planning and open source software as like the market? I think that's a little bit of a facile analogy. I mean, yeah, sure, there are advantages from open source, you know, taking advantage of distributed knowledge and providing incentives and so on. I mean, there are a lot of open source projects that are great, but not necessarily. I mean, this is an entrepreneurial decision. There are some cases in which entrepreneurial direction, you know, top-down planning by the management team within a private company leads to a better product than the one that would emerge from decentralized, you know, completely decentralized spontaneous order. That's something that only internet or software entrepreneurs can decide. Okay, well, thanks a lot for listening. Not one of you asked a question in the chat window that stumped me. I nailed all of them today. But anyway, please do express your comments on the forums, and please join me if you can Friday at 10:30 Eastern for our regularly scheduled office hours. See you later.